I appreciate being able to talk to a nice S2 group and an S9 group, and I'm an S3 person, so this is a good adventure for me. So a few years ago, we became interested in nanomaterials, and primarily manufactured nanomaterials. I want to differentiate what we do from some of the other talks I heard this morning. So what we became interested in was fullerenes primarily, but that has expanded tremendously of late to other forms of carbon nanomaterials as well as nanometals, which is our latest adventure, which I'm not going to talk about today. I can make comments about them, but I'm embargoed on speaking on them from my co-authors. So we put together a group, and you see the names there, but basically what we became intrigued with was looking at the environmental effects, looking at the, and we broke that up into four parts in terms of what's going on. At the time we started on this, the carbon nanomaterials were largely, especially fullerene, was largely an unknown in the environment, and still I think a bit unknown in the environment, given the recent calls that are out and some other things that are going on with interest in the materials. So we broke it up into four parts. We were looking at the solubility in water and mixed solvents for fullerene, toxicity of C60, and that's a specific estimation method we were using in terms of bioluminescent bacteria. I won't speak on that today, but it's using a bioluminescent arrangement to look for problems with membranes. Then my specific area were the last two, where it's in shifts in response to microbial populations in aerobic, anaerobic systems, as well as pure cultures. And then we also listed the long-term fate in the environment as controlled by fungi. And to this group, we have basically four or five PIs involved. The solubility work's being done by Chad Jaffert in civil engineering. Toxicity work's being done by Bruce Applegate in food science. The shifts in response in microbial populations is myself and my research group, as well as Larry Nyes in civil engineering, who's a professor. He's a biochemist professor who snuck into civil engineering. And the long-term fate work is done by Tim Philly in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences in the School of Science. So it's a pretty diverse group. And all this feeds into our outreach and education program, which is run by Natalie Carroll through 4-H. So we have a diverse group involved here with this project. I'm going to speak to parts of this today in terms of some things that might be of interest to this organization. So our major component in this is trying to understand the impacts on the food web, at the base of the food web in terms of bacteria and fungi, and how would intersection of those organisms with nanomaterials either affect the organisms, which is primarily what we're interested in, or be affected, will the nanomaterials be affected by the particular organisms that are there. So it's a back and forth situation. We're interested in the effects on the organisms as well as the effects of the organisms on the nanomaterials. So that's really where we sort of work, is in that box that's indicated there. I forgot we have to use the little cursor. This box right here, in terms of what's going on in the system. Now, other folks around the country are working with the up the food chain a bit. There's work going on with nematodes and protozoa in some places, and all kinds of other organisms. There's a lot of worm work going on with nanomaterials, especially related to some of the EPA work that's out there. So there is quite a bit of interest in these things, and we took the sort of the base of the food chain to work from. So when we started this, there was not we didn't have the information we needed. We didn't have I'm a microbiologist. I've been basically, my background is in pesticide degradation and organic transformations, organics in the environment. And there are certain things I like to know about a compound. Number one, I like to know kind of what its solubility is. That's always a good thing to know, right? And then I want to know what its KOW is, so I can figure out whether it's going to sorb or not. And then I want to know how it's going to behave in a system. So it turned out when you have pure C60, you have fullerenes, C60 material, we didn't have any of that information at the outset. So that was one of our key pieces of information, of work, was trying to understand what the solubility was, and then what the partitioning coefficient components are, and then how it behaved in water. And that was what Chad worked on. Chad Jaffert's still working on that. He has a paper coming out in ESNT, probably in January or February. It was just accepted 2 days ago, fully accepted 2 days ago, on the octanol work I'm showing you here right now in terms of determining the KOW values for pure fullerene. And you got to remember, fullerene, I'll get ahead on that, but fullerene has an interesting behavior in water. So what Chad has been able to determine is that the octanol saturated water solubility is about 6.4 times 10 to the minus 7 milligrams per liter. And which gives us an approximate, Chad worked out an approximate log KOW about 7.73 for pure fullerene, okay, which is a pretty high KOW. So it's and I have some comparison in a second for what that means. He's also of late, and this is the second paper that's in submission, looking at the solubility of pure fullerene, and he's been able to estimate that out at something between 1 and 10 nanograms per liter. And he's got a little better number on it than that range, but he'd prefer to publish that first before I start talking about it to people. So he's using a generator column method because of such as you obviously see, there's such poor solubility of the material. It's hard to work with in terms of trying to determine these things. So Chad has worked out this generator column method and is showing about a 1 to 10 nanograms per liter level of solubility for pure fullerene. Well, this show sort of shows you where that sits in the world of organics that are out there in terms of naphthalene, DDT, etc. So C60, a pure C60, is on the high side on the log KOW, which would imply that it would probably be fairly well absorbed in soil systems. And 7.73 is tentative, but I think it's pretty solid. It's pretty close to that in terms of what's being published now. So a pretty solid value for C60 log KOW. So it's a high value. It's going to be retained by soils and so organic matter, and probably retained by anything that likes to retain hydrophobic materials. So it's a pretty strong number in that regard. It's a very high number in terms of log KOW. So I wasn't sure what this group had experiences with C60 were, so I thought I'd show you a bit about how this material is worked with in terms of when we use it in the biological process. Chad works with the pure material. He works in a very pure system in terms of the material. We work with a water-solubilized form of C60, okay? And a water-solubilized form of C60 is what you're seeing over here on the yellow bottle. That's a concentrated form. So what you start out with C60 is this saturated solution, and this is the way we do it and a lot of other people do it, saturated solution in THF, okay? And then you move that, you do some filtration steps and reconcentration and through that, and you end up with this clear material, which is, again, fullerenes in THF at solubility. And then you go through a series of concentration steps where you move it into water. And you do some rotovapping, quite a bit of rotovapping. In fact, our rotovapor is about to wear out. So much of the work we've done with it recently. And then you end up with this solution on the yellow solution, which is typical coloring for fullerene solution in a solubilized in water, is that yellow color. So that's about what you end up with. You take a particle, it's a physical particle, it's a granular material. You don't really solubilize it, you're suspending it, and it suspends into water through this kind of process. This is a pretty standard approach. Now, the other way you get fullerene in the water is to take pure fullerene granules, put it in water and leave it there and spin it for up to 6, 8, 10 weeks, that range. And you can avoid the THF that way if you want to work without THF in the system. So it's possible to get fullerene to go in the water with time. It's also, we tend to want to push things along a little bit, so we use the fullerene approach, which was first used by a number of other people. So what happens, and this is Chad's other piece of work that he's about to submit, is that Chad feels that there's a micelle formation. This is definitely not the scale, but the fullerene comes in as a particle material, and in water it tends to form a micelle. And the micelle shape and size is controlled by lots of things, including the salt concentration, the speed of mixing, which we use as a trick to make different size of particles. And what you end up with in this process is this is how the NC60, the water solubilized C60, looks in solution. It's a clump or a gathering of smaller fullerene materials, and it's a sphere, I guess, is how you think of it, or a micelle arrangement. So Chad has worked out a very nice piece of work. I've seen the draft on this whole process and what's going on, and he's also able to estimate the sorption coefficients for the NC60 values in soil systems. So that's another step forward in trying to understand their environmental fate in the environment. The size of that structure on the right there is controlled, again, by salts in the system, and it's controlled by solution mixing speed and a lot of other little things that you can do to make it go bigger or smaller in terms of its behavior. But this is, Chad's going to propose in his paper that this is going to happen to any fluorine that enters the environment or enters water will in some way end up in a micelle arrangement if it's presented with some friends to form that arrangement. So that's sort of how it sits in water. And this goes by the name of NC60, which is an agglomeration of particles of C60 into these shapes. And that's what's giving you the yellow color is also is that little suspension material. That's what we work with primarily is this NC60 arrangement. So from all that, I want to tell you a little bit about our work in terms of soils work and our biosolids work in terms of NC60 and C60 and our fungal work in terms of NC60 and C60. Mostly the fungal work's been done with pure C60. But so in terms of the soils we work with, we have two soils primarily in this project, a drummer soil, which has organic matter of about 3.6, and a tracy sandy soil, which has nice sand content of about 55%, which is by far my favorite soil. It's just a lot easier to work with, but it doesn't represent a whole lot of places. So it's got a low organic matter content, but it's got a high sand content. Again, I showed you the procedure for the formation of the material. It's basically the one we've used for all our procedures with the THF. In any of our biology work we do, we always throw in a THF control. In other words, we run THF through all the process without the presence of C60. So we have at least some simulation of the residual level of THF in terms of its effect on microbial process. That was something that wasn't getting done in the literature. We sort of hope to bring that along in terms of a control situation. We do concentration, and you do size of crystals by dynamic light scattering. So that was a new adventure for us also. So we have a series of procedures and processes we've been using to look at the behavior of this material in soil and its impact on soil processes. We've evaluated microbial forms in terms of phospholipid fatty acid patterns, and I'll show you data on that. Biomass size impacts, in other words, does fluorine affect the size of the standing population in soil if you apply it at high concentrations, or this is also for sludge as well, biosolids as well. We've used PCR-DDGE with three domains in terms of bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotic primers to see if there's an effect on the genetic structure of the genetic structure of the soil. And now we moved into looking at functions of the system as affected by the presence of the material. We do that with either CO2 or methane formation, native materials, or we look at glucose assimilation now. We're using a C14 glucose assimilation procedure to sort of sort out whether we've impacted the overall process in the system. And finally, you can buy C13 fluorine. It's a very fairly readily available material. And then all our fungal work has been done with C13 fluorine to look for enrichment and transfer of the signal that way. So that's sort of the background of what we've done procedure-wise. And this is a series of results here in terms of what's going on. And it's a very similar story for most of this. So you won't be imagining when I keep saying the same thing. NC60 and C60 have basically had little impact on soil function in terms of application. And we've applied this at basically at a very wide range. We've applied NC60 at 1 part per million, or C60, the dry granule crystals, at about 1,000 parts per million to drummer soil. And what you're seeing here is short-term soil respiration, general CO2 respiration out of the system. Or over here is biomass size as determined by phospholipid phosphate. And what you're seeing are basically no effects from the presence of either the small levels of NC60 or C60 at very high level introductions. So that's some of our initial work that we've done on this to assess impact. These are all the treatments here across the bottom. Just plain soil, THF in soil, C60 and then C60 in the systems, and no significant difference. We also did a microbial profiling of the system, and we used DGGE, and this is bacterial primers for looking at microbial impacts. And again, you see almost no change in the signature structures from the DGGE and the bacterial primers. And phospholipid showed some movement around, but nothing that was significant in terms of what was going on in the system. So we again declared that that either at 3 or 6 months of incubation in the presence, there's no major shifts in the soil structure as related to the phospholipid signal or to the DDG pattern with the bacterial primers. So that was in our first paper on this, and basically what we've said at that point in time was that that the materials had little impact on soil function as we were testing it, and that we thought sorption, and at that time we had some knowledge of the sorption values that Chad was working out, was a controlling factor in what was going on, and we still think that even more in that regard. So then we come in now, we've sort of taken a little different approach, and what we're doing now is we're doing challenge experiments in the presence of nanomaterials. And I say nanomaterials here because this is expanded a bit. You're seeing only our C60 data, but this is expanded to include a single wall carbon nanotubes, functionalized nanotubes, as well as nanosilver in terms of looking at this response method. And what this basically does is we apply the nanomaterial to soil, we incubate it for some time period, and we subsample, we apply C14 glucose to look at respiration response at points along the way in terms of an incubation. And at, this is the data set for the CO2, C14 glucose response at 6 months. And as you can see, there's very little difference between any of the treated samples in terms of the nanomaterials. This approach we feel allows us to sort of track things that we can't get back out very readily. C60 is hard to recover from soil, though. I think some procedures are coming on that will allow us at least to see where it is in there fairly shortly. So this is giving us a way to assess impact in a fairly easy manner on the system. We've used this for looking at metals in the past and a couple other things. We think it's a very it's an adaption of some old soil microbiology approaches in terms of respiration of glucose. So this is a further adaption of our process. We became intrigued with looking at double stresses on the system. So one of the major stresses in soil is water, and so we did a series of incubations in the presence of NC60, C60, and carbon-12, charcoal, at different water potentials from dry to wet. And lo and behold, after 50 days of incubation, using the respiratory response method I just showed you, there were very few impacts on the soil response. In fact, there's no statistical difference between any of the treatments. So again, even in the presence of a second stress, water potential, which for soil microorganisms is a big stress, we didn't see a combined response in terms of the presence of any of the nanomaterials, the C60 or the NC60 or even charcoal in the system. So again, this is part of another paper that's about done in terms of what's going on in the system, looking at the secondary stresses. Something we're also interested in. This graphic shows. This is phospholipid data on a PCA analysis, and this shows again that there was no statistical difference within the patterning except for the two soil types, which is typical of phospholipid. You can always confirm your bag labels with phospholipid. If you join phospholipid samples correctly, you generally get the soils to separate on your PCA analysis, and you can always check to make sure your bag labels are correct that way. Just it's sort of a secondary. It's a very expensive procedure to do that with, but. But it did show that we did separate the two soils that we were working with, but there was no real statistical or significant clustering or grouping related to either water potential effects on the populations in the soil or on the combination of C60 with water potential. So there was no combined effects on the population as indicated by the fatty acid patterns. So we also, my grad students is working on looking at the other. I should back up. The other thing that has been brought up in the literature and been discussed at great length in the literature because of some work on pure cultures that showed smaller NC60 crystal size affected bacteria differently than larger NC60 crystal size. There's been some discussion of that. So we went through a procedure, and we're still going through this procedure of recovering and making NC60 at different sizes, okay, and ranging from about 50-51 nanometers at the core of the distribution up to about 250 nanometers. And the goal here is to sort of make a different set of sizes for the NC60, apply those to the soil, and then we use that respiratory response method with the glucose to try to understand what's going on. And in both cases, we've seen no response or no differences in the system in either one of our two soils in terms of the size of the crystal affecting the response in the system. The theory was that the smaller the NC60 crystal size is, the more negative effect it would have because of some pure culture work that had shown a very similar response. But we weren't able to show that in soil, in neither of our two soils we work on. So again, same story. Very little data, very little support for any effect of NC60 or HC60 on soil function in the systems. Let me jump ahead a little bit here in this other piece of work. We also had a component in this looking at biosolids in terms of effects of C60 on biosolids, and in this case we're looking at anaerobic digester sludge, and this is Larry's portion of the project, Larry Nice's portion of the project, and this paper has just been accepted in ESNT also on biosolids. Oh, it's been accepted for revisions. There's always those pesky revisions. The biosolids work is will be in ESNT hopefully in March. What we did was we collected biosolids from West Lafayette Treatment Plant, and we incubated them in different ways and looked at form and function within the system. And now this number is correct. It's 50,000 parts per million of applied C60. And it was put in with an organic solvent, and the organic solvent was removed. It was plated on the glass, and the biosolids were applied. So there's a huge concentration of C60 in that system. And it basically, I'm going to tell you the same story again. There was no response or no difference in the gas. This is gas volume in these systems over 90 days, and the treatments on aren't here, but there's a bunch of different little treatments. But there was no difference in how the materials behaved in these systems. So under the anaerobic conditions, the anaerobic incubations, we saw no major difference in biogas production in those systems. We also did a series of again DGGE recoveries looking at changes impossibly in microbial structure within the anaerobic digester biosolids at these incredibly high concentrations. And again, there was no differences in the patterns in terms of the bacterial primers or in terms of the archaea primers, which is a major component, in methane formation in biodigester solids. And we see no differences there in terms of the patterns in the DGGE response from those primers. And we also looked at eukarya and the different treatments. That slide should go in earlier. But so the response again was everything was pretty similar in terms of what we were looking at. Depending on, there was no difference with the concentration. We didn't see any kind of effect of the form of the C60. 30,000, 50,000 gave us, and it didn't matter how we plated it on there, or how we put it in there, we didn't see any response in any of those systems to that presence of incredibly high concentrations of C60 in these anaerobic digester sludges. Now the fungal work is Tim Philly's part of the project, and the reason we're interested in fungi is that they're known to produce a series of enzymes that degrade lignin and other difficult to degrade materials. So Tim has been doing a series of block incubations looking at formation of C13 of gases from the system and looking at incorporation of C13 from the C60 into the biomass of the headspace gases. And basically, this is a very abbreviated slide here of what's the ratios of these things. We don't see any major changes in the signals from the treated and the untreated systems. So for C60, I have to be careful how I say this because there's a different story developing with some other material. For C60, the granular C60 applied to these different things with these different kinds of fungi, we didn't see a difference in the delta 13 signals in the systems. So Tim's grad student's writing this up right now. Now, the major caveat on this is that we think we see, if there's any alteration in the C60 structure, say, for example, the presence of a hydroxyl group, presence of hydroxyl groups or carboxylic groups, this story changes. And that enzymes from the fungi may in fact be involved with some pretty significant degradation of those materials. Now that's ongoing, and there's a series of projects still in place on that. And this is just to give you some picture of what's going on in these systems. I'm kind of intrigued by the way Tim does this in terms of the applications to the wood blocks and then breaks them all up and extracts them. Okay, so in summary, it's a good story. It's a good news, bad news story. The bad news is I can't create great levels of fear in the populace in terms of the behavior of NC60. The good news is I can't create huge behavior fears in the populace because of NC60 or C60. We're not seeing a negative impact on, we see basically no impact on soils and biosolid materials from the presence of these materials. We see the transformation of C60 by fungi is very limited. The transformation of C60 by a modified C60 may be a bit different. So some substituted groups on there may change the picture a bit. And what we're moving into now is looking at carbon nanotubes, functionalized carbon nanotubes with different materials on the outside to look at their impact. We're also looking at nanosilver and its impact on soil process and a number of these other materials. So with that, I believe that's the last question or the last slide, and I got to do that. I'll be stricken from the federal record if I don't. Support for this came from NSF and from EPA. So this group is it's a pretty big group. So we're very grateful to NSF and EPA for this project support. Yes, ma'am.
Are you surprised to see that there was no effect of the -1.5 megapascal water potential between the two soils? Just even on the control, would you have expected to see?
Yes, I would have expected to see something, and I'm a little miffed I didn't see something, and I'm not sure why. So we're struggling with that question right now.
Generally, I think it's really neat what you're doing in terms of applying.
You repeat my question.
The question is, would I have expected to see? Some kind of change in the phospholipid signature with the presence of different levels of water in the soils. All right, and that's been bothering me actually because I saw a talk the other day that showed some differences there in that response, and we've seen it in the past and once in some studies we've done. So I'm looking at the data to make sure we haven't missed something. So because I would have expected to see some kind of signal shift. The only thing I can think of is that the incubation times weren't long enough to cause a major change in the structure. That is my story for the paper. So,
questions? Brian, could you comment on is there any relationship between the octanol water partition coefficient and interactions with microbes?
Yeah, well, in soil, I think the octanol water coefficient basically is helping to protect them because it's being sorbed to organic matter and going out of soil solution. We have right now an experiment where we've taken soil and we're basically making a slurry out of it, and we're trying to force a negative response by creating a very high, at least at some point in the experiment, a very high solution concentration of C60 to see if we can cause a response. Because Pedro Alvarez and a number of people have published data to show that you can get a negative response, and I think you'll see some later from fluorines on bacteria. And I think it's because of if you can keep it in solution, you can get a negative response. I think in the soil system, you can't keep it in solution long enough because it doesn't like water, and it runs away, as you saw by that number, into the organic matter.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Ron. Oh, one more?
Yeah.
Joe?
I just had a comment on that. I think you could make a good argument that the affinity for a fluorine particle would be even greater on the surface of a cell than it would be on a soil organic matter surface because of the...
Yeah. That would be explaining the pure culture work, I think, where they show they can show a negative effect from the when you put it into solution, you get bacteria to die off pretty readily. When you put it in the soil, I think there's more soil than bacteria, so you lose it onto the organic matter. I think the soil acts as a good protectant for the population. But we're trying to force that to see if we can make that story make sense out of that story right now.
Okay, well, thank you, Ron.
Sure.